Thanks for coming out tonight to see our conversation and ask a few things yourself of Poe Bronson. Really glad to have him with us. Poe is a novelist, journalist, and author of a number of nonfiction books, including Why Do I Love These People? And What Should I Do With My Life? He lives in San Francisco with his wife and his two kids. He's here tonight to talk about his new book. It's called Nurture Shock, and we're very glad to have him. Welcome, Poe Bronson.
Thank you. Thank you.
So the thing about your book, to me, Poe, especially for those of us who have young kids, is that in any number of chapters, you are messing with parental instinct in a really big way. Are you pointing out how the science is running counter to or challenging sort of some of the instincts we have as parents, you know, to comfort our kids, to trust our kids, to believe in their innocence, you know, on a number of levels, talk to them constantly, you know, think that they'll actually be helped by watching educational television shows. Before we get into the details of so many of the points that you make in the book, how do you think actual science and, I guess, you know, our best notion of what truth is got so out of line along the way with what our gut tells us?
Okay, I think that that's an illusion that when we're trusting our gut. I think when we're trusting our gut or what we feel our instincts are actually this long time well of old disproven psychology and fads of the time that no generation for 100 years has been immune to the advice of parenting experts. And in the past, most of these parenting experts studied, you know, their own kids and then generalized it to everybody else, or they studied small populations only in a certain part of the country, and certainly not cross-culturally, and certainly not doing longitudinal studies in the same way. And a lot of the theory was just theory, but it became what are today's instincts. They sort of entered the zeitgeist and then got pounded back down, and we just sort of soaked them up, and we sort of intuit them in a way that, but they're not actually, you know, parenting instincts. You know?
What are the forces that have been driving that? Are we talking about like self-help books, and why are we culturally so inclined?
Self-help books are a really good thing, because in the late 60s and the early 70s, a lot of before really the self-help book genre really boomed, a lot of the psychology was based on doctors sampling their clinical population. And so if the work by Anna Freud or Peter Blas, they came in and they were looking at the kids who were in trouble, and they were coming into their clinics, and so they were what is the situation for these kids in trouble? And then they generalize that to all kids. Mm-hmm. A good example of that would be the narrative of what it was like to be a teen and whether conflict with your parents was normative or abnormal. And if for the clinical population, it was totally normal to have incredible heated arguments and enormous rebellion with parents. But outside the clinical population, the teens were sort of like, it's kind of fine, actually. It's not so bad. And to some extent, these narratives created fears in the public, and the self-help movement could come along to try to help people deal with these fears, but in some way actually perpetuating the narrative too, and in perpetuating the narrative also in sustaining and inflaming people's fears. And so what's happened in the science has been something dramatic. Not all science today is great science by any means. Ashley and I go to these conferences, and we come home with stacks of posters, you know, 8 inches thick, and we can, in the course of a week, throw out 6 inches of that poster. It's sort of good science, but supporting what we all already know. There's nothing new there. It almost feels sort of irrelevant. And there's a smaller body of it that's really great work that's doing long-term trajectories, that's looking at science cross-culturally, that's doing cluster analysis, that's finding confirmation in neuroscience and genetics, that is suddenly making it a much harder science that's able to statistically measure things that we just didn't measure before.
But you point out in the book at a couple of occasions that it's actually still challenging to get grant money to study, quote-unquote, normal kids.
That's right. So we were talking, again, going back to the idea that old science was based on clinical population, kids in trouble. Mm. The granting system for child development research is certainly focused on, as it should be, helping kids in need, whether they're at-risk kids or they're kids who are falling behind. The child development science is not engineered towards or oriented towards developing super kids. And to some extent, if you study a normal population, that's been a little bit that's been a little bit tricky in some cases. And but I think that the grantors have started to say, we need to know what's normal. They recognize this thing. And so what's normative has been kicked out. It's well understood in the sciences over the last 5 years. In the last 5 years, I've really reproduced everything cross-culturally in many countries. And all the science in the book has been reproduced in many countries around the world. And what we're getting out right now is these really long-term studies. If you're just interested, for instance, in the question of, you know, how do the popular kids in high school really turn out when they're 30 years old? Like, was their popular years, was that the heyday? Or does it actually, do they still really doing well? That's a very specific body of research by Toon Salesin. But that, you know, Hilt's going to have those findings 2 years from now. And we know that that's coming. We'll be able to answer that question.
Oh, but we don't know how they turn out.
Well, they're looking at it right now. I can tell you, I think it's too early to talk about that data.
Okay, I'm rooting for their downfall, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I figured you were. Yeah.
No. I could dive into any number of specific topics here, and we'll get into them, but I thought I'd start maybe by asking you if there's anything from the book, anything that you discovered through the course of reporting the book, that you've had a particularly hard time adjusting to yourself with your own family and in how you work with your own kids.
Yeah, well, the story that started it all off is, which we stumbled into, was about the science of praise. And to simplify it, it said, don't tell your kids they're smart all the time, and don't praise them all the time either, because then you won't wire up their brains to go through periods of delayed gratification. And
let's just put a fine point on this. We're all so attuned, I think. Well, my son's 16 months old, and maybe it's too early to even be thinking about this, but you just want to say, you know, good boy all the time. And he's not doing anything significant, really.
Right.
He's not, you know, he's not curing cancer here.
What is driving
he's just
that compulsion
up.
To think kids somehow need a cheerleading section for every single crawl, you know, every single grab? I mean, I think that we're projecting a lot of our own insecurities. I mean, the science hasn't looked exactly what drove that. But again, I think it was is sort of in the zeitgeist from the self-esteem movement, certainly. But I, for one instance, I was praising my kids all the time. I felt the same compulsion to be their cheerleader. But I had lived through the heyday of the self-esteem movement, but I never studied that science. It wasn't like I read books about self-esteem and was applying them to my kids. I just kind of got there through the zeitgeist. But I, too, felt like I needed to do that all the time.
And your kids are a little older now?
Now my son's 8 and my daughter's 5.
Okay.
And I learned for a good couple of years there not to tell them they're smart all the time and focus on hard work and effort and specific strategies. And, you know, a lot of the time just let them go. Like, my son, he knows how well he did on the math test or his spontaneous. He doesn't need me to tell him it's good or bad. You know, he needs to make his own determination. Okay, but I slip up a lot. And we recently were taping Nightline, and I was at their soccer practice, and you know, they were trying to, the video cameras were trying to show me being this this new kind of coach. I was still like, brilliant, that's awesome, great, you know.
Well, how would you?
And then the truth is, my son, he wasn't very smart when he was 5. He was rejected by all the private schools, but his brain wired up. Pokemon wired up his brain.
Well, so you're out there.
But I'll just say this.
So now
he's in third grade, but by the time he was in fall of second grade, thanks to doing tons of Pokemon, his math teacher said he was faster at math than almost all the fifth graders in the school. So what's happening there is these white matter tracts that connect the prefrontal cortex to the parietal cortex they're tuning up, they're being encapsulated in sheaths of fat, which makes them 100 times faster. And when this happens, you get these incredible speed gains, and that clearly was what happened to his brain. You couldn't have seen that was going to happen when he was 5. It will happen to all kids, or most kids, unless they're having some form of dyslexia.
And just on that point,
I tell him, I can't help but sometimes tell him he's smart.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes it's merited, I would think, right? Well, that's okay.
Well, we can get into that.
We can talk about how smart your son is. But let's put you back out on the soccer field.
Yeah.
Just to put a fine point on this, because it's one of the things that's really captured people's imagination that you dig into in the book. And so how do you, as a soccer coach or a dad on the sidelines, give praise in a constructive way?
Yeah, well, first, I'm a soccer player, so this, I teach them very specific strategies. Like, when you get the ball, I do not want you to kick it, and I don't want you to crash into it. I want you to turn around and go backwards. And that's very hard to resist this impulse on the soccer field. But if you watch any good team, they pass it backwards as much as they pass it forwards. And I want you to swing the ball around. And I want you to never stop the ball and trap it. I teach them never to trap the ball. I teach them to first touch into space. And so I reward them for doing the exact, like, simplified tactics that will teach them to be dynamic players and
specifics,
not the kind of robotic players. But it's very specific,
okay,
or in theory. But then you watch the tape when Nightline was there, and I, you know, they were doing it right, and there was the cameras turned on, and they passed it 8 times in a row, and these are second graders, you know, and right through the other team, and I was just full of love, you know. So.
And what is the science telling us that kids who are just generically told that they're smart, that are, you know, praised for doing well, that are praised even when they don't do anything in particular, they internalize that, and what effect does it have on them?
Well, telling kids they're smart conveys the idea that it's about whether you have it or you don't. It conveys a construct that it's something about you innately so, whether you're born with it or not, just that you have it. And, of course, this is what we parents, of course, want them to think. We want them to think, when you're feeling challenged, you're not sure if you've got it or not, I want, you know, you to know you do have it.
You can do it.
And we all know the sort of the steamrolling effect of confidence. So we're trying to give kids this sort of confidence in the moment. But you can't generate it artificially, because what you end up teaching them is this idea that it's all about innate constructs, be it intelligence, shyness, creativity. They all work like this. And instead, you have to focus on variables that they can enhance or change or deal with when in times of difficulty. And that's why praising them for their effort or focusing on hard their work or specific strategies that help them deal with times of difficulty is where you actually teach them self-efficacy, not self-esteem. Kids who are told they're intelligent a lot, they begin obsessed with their image of whether they're smart or not, as if seen by others. And they are risk-averse when it comes to academic challenges, because they don't want to get things wrong in front of their peers at a very young age. Over time, they become obsessed with not wanting to have a B on their transcript. And their debt sort of would just be so horrible, you know, for their college admissions or their high school admissions and that kind of thing. Over time, further on, then they have a hard time choosing majors and a hard time choosing careers, the studies show.
And before we move on from praise, I'll say, if anybody has any questions along this line, feel free to jump in here after my next one. One example you give in the book that I thought was really fascinating was a study that looked at both American kids and Chinese kids,
yeah,
in Hong Kong, right?
Yes.
And their parents, of course. Tell me briefly how that was conducted and what it showed.
Well, this work by Flory Ng in Illinois and in Hong Kong had kids, fifth graders, in the scholars lab come in with their mothers. And the fifth graders went into a room. They did a little 10-minute pattern-finding IQ test. And their mothers on the outside, they were going to take two tests. There would be like a 10-minute break in between. And the mothers were told a lie. The mothers were told, no matter how well the kid had done, this was your kid's score, which was the true score. And then, but the mom didn't know what that score was, that score good or bad, so they were told, it's not very good. And the American mothers were like, oh, yes, well, at school, we're working on this and this thing. And oh, yes, and he's had some issues. And, you know, even since he was young, there'd be this problem. And they would clearly really psychologically wear this hard that their kid had sort of been a little below average. And they would obsess with the researcher, the grad student, about how, you know, I'm going to get him tutoring, I'm going to do all this stuff, right? And then they were allowed to go in and visit their child. And the American mothers went in, and to watch the tapes, they'd never mentioned performance, never mentioned anything. Oh, how's your test? It seems fine. What do you want to go eat afterwards? And so they were carrying all this weight, but then shielding it from their child. The Chinese mothers did something quite different. They were told, you know, your child's a little below average. And they were like, get out of my way. And they were running there. And they sat down with their kid, and they're like, it was more than just you need to work harder. It was you need to work harder, but also you need to concentrate more. So, like, we got 10 minutes. Let's study. And they would say, let's look at the practice tests. Look at the ones that you did. And they would say, well, look, you didn't. You looked this way and this way. And they kind of helped coach them. And the kids really, like, learned. And the parents were focused on efficacy again. How do you do better on this kind of thing? And what was interesting, and then the kids took their second test. And the American kids did a little better because it had a little practice. But the Chinese kids' scores, these are IQ scores. So they jumped 33%. And what's interesting is you might think there's a trade-off between, like, the lovingness, the affection, the unconditional love right. of that we think the American parents gave, and the real conditional love of the Chinese parents in Hong Kong. But actually, and they scored the videotapes, the Chinese mothers were every bit as sort of physically affectionate, touching, supportive, and sort of, you know, just kind of huggy with their kids as the American mothers were. It was complete love from the Chinese mothers, but the focus was on you can do better. Oh yeah.
Anybody have any questions with regard to the sort of the praise stuff, which of course has been featured in the press? Yeah. Let's see. I have a question right back there. Remember, just give us your name and where you're from.
My name is Sean. I happen to be one of the Chinese parents.
Yeah.
So I totally agree what you describe, but I want to add something there, is that there's a difference between the culture here and also some country difference there. What I say that the Chinese parent, they do have a reason to encourage their kids to work hard, because when I graduated from high school back in China, and the percentage graduated went to college was only 4%. So you don't work hard, you don't go to college, you're done. So that's my comment on that. Also, I would say that some of the Chinese parents actually do too much to pressure their kids. So I've been in this country for about 19 years. I kind of learned a little bit culture here as well. And I certainly don't agree with a lot of American families that don't, you know, say, well, you're okay, no matter whatever your transcripts are. But I also think that the Chinese mother also probably do a little bit too much.
Okay, well, it's interesting. In terms of how parents, Chinese parents, pressure their kids, this is well-studied science. Specifically as it relates to praise and praise feedback, Florey's work out of Hong Kong is quite different than what's going on. I mean, you shouldn't generalize to all of China in a day and age like today, because other work by Kang Ling Lei out of Taiwan and the big cities of China shows that exactly as you're describing, it worked really well to tell everybody, work really hard, and then these new outcomes that weren't available to prior generations are suddenly there for you, right? You can go to college like no one had gone to college before. But it's actually so competitive in some places now that there's a lot of kids who have actually worked, they've been told their whole life by teachers especially. Parents give specific strategy, but teachers in China today tend to just say, work harder, you're not working hard enough, and they don't actually give them specific strategies. And the result is these kids actually come to see how hard they can work, not as a variable they can control, but as something innate they can't control. And this is a terrible rebound going on in China, where kids have been promised outcomes, but because it's so competitive, they're not getting into the best schools. Not every kid is getting an A. And a lot of them are saying, I guess I can't work very hard. I've been told my whole life it's about how hard I work. I'm not successful. I guess I can't work very hard. And they're getting huge rates of depression in those kids. So the lesson there had to do with teachers doing far more than just say, work hard, you're not working hard enough. Again, there was a lot of negativity to it, you're not working hard enough. And just, again, you know, my daughter's 5, she's learning to read. She doesn't need to be told to work hard, she needs to be told, make your consonant sound, or make your consonant vowel transitions, keep your finger on the page, don't look at me. There's specific strategies she needs to do to learn. And teachers in China need to get back to teaching the specific strategies each kid needs to learn. Is the extent of this science throughout China and what it's finding in different regions is really fascinating.
We have another question?
Hi, yes, I have a question about the standard self-fulfilling prophecy. That's something we were taught that's a truism or something that happens. What's your take on that? Is there such a thing as a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Yeah, it is. If you tell kids that they're really tidy and neat, they will be tidier and neat than if you teach them how to be tidier and neat. So in certain constructs, you can just label a child and it becomes self-fulfilling, right? But you have to recognize the situations where that works. People assumed that that would hold true for praise as well. And the science of praise, until Carol Dweck's work came along, did show that if you praised kids, it boosted them, it helped them, as long as they never experienced difficulty. So tidying your house, it's not like you walk in one day and you have this insurmountable challenge to tidying the house. So you pick up your socks, pick up your shoes, whatever it is. And, you know, if you think about a kid learning to read or learning to do math, this is like massively more cognitively demanding than anything their little preschool brain has ever had to deal with before. They learn language, but they learn that implicitly. And this is something for the first time doing this sort of explicit knowledge learning. And their motivation personality will be formed in that process. And so the science of praise says you need to equip children for how to handle moments of difficulty, and you have to watch out for thinking you can sort of gerrymander confidence through self-fulfilling prophecies. Yeah. Similar thing is this sort of redshirting kindergarten phenomenon. In kindergarten class this year is the oldest kindergarten class we've ever had, and that's largely because of the number of kids who've been held back a year to start, say, when they're 6 rather than when they're 5, to simplify it a little bit. And there had been some science that comparative advantage of being a little bit older, it was sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You'd be seen by everyone as a little bit smarter. They're in kindergarten. And then you would garner more resources over time. And there was science from that, this Bedard study at UC Santa Barbara. And it's quoted in Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers and Liz Wiles' New York Times article from 2007. And it's led to huge pockets of our country, everybody redshirting their kids, thinking, I can help my kid by giving him comparative advantage. My kid can think he's a little better than the other kids in his class, and that will snowball over time. The most recent data from this summer, which is based on a study that used every single birth certificate in the United States from 1989 to 2001, every single birth certificate has sort of disproved that. And it proved that these long-lasting gains we thought were there. We thought that eighth-grade kids who were older were 4 to 8 percentage points better than the ones who were younger. It turned out it's not that. It's actually they're just more disproportionately likely to be born to affluent families, because it turns out that poor families and rich families don't give birth at the same time of year in the same proportions. They don't really know why that's the case, but it's true in every single year of the data. And so again, parents are redshirting their kindergartner because they think, I'm going to make him feel a little stronger, a little more socially ready, a little more cognitively adept than his classmates. And hoping it would be a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it turns out to be an illusion.
I'm Jeff Horwich, host of In the Loop, and you're listening to a conversation with author Poe Bronson, co-author of the book Nurture Shock. I'm going to give you one other point that goes in a little different direction here. This really stuck with me when I read the book, that it can be good, not always good, but it can be good for parents to argue in front of their kids.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that feels unnatural. Seems like for very good reason. But what's the science there?
Yeah, well, this is Mark Cummings' work out of Notre Dame. And this is a guy who, Mark is a very careful scholar, tremendous scholar, a legend in his field. And it was, in fact, his work that was being relied on for a long time that said, more blanketly, don't fight in front of your kids. It's bad for them. Take it upstairs. And just the science has gotten drilled down more carefully on that. The truth is that when spouses keep diaries, they men say they fight or argue or bicker, you know, 6 times a day. Wives will say they do it 7 times a day. I don't know where the other one's going. But
we don't notice the other one.
We didn't notice that. We didn't notice the dirty look, right? And that most kids actually are exposed to some conflict and some tension in the home. And So first of all, parents who think they can hide it from their kids probably aren't hiding it from their kids. The second thing is, and this is something that Mark is, this has been welling up in his research now for 3 or 4 years, but he's only felt comfortable talking about it starting about 6 months ago, which is that kids in his studies who are allowed to witness the end of an argument, who see a conflict resolved honestly, not faking it, they will feel just fine after witnessing parents' arguments. And in a separate study showing that at school, kids who witness constructive arguing between parents have overall greater well-being, are more pro-social in school, have a lot better relationship skills. And the idea is that if you deprive your child completely of seeing how conflict is worked out, then when they have conflict in their lives, they don't know how to deal with it. And actually, if you roll, you know, we're talking about fight. He does these reproduced experiments, and the fighting can get quite intense in front of the kids. But if it's then worked out, and again, we're not saying faking it; we're talking about really working it out. Because mm-hmm. you know, when couples fight, a lot of the time is, you know, they kind of want to fight. You know, it's like you kind of want to get your digs in. You're feeling it's like, and you know, sometimes you're feeling secure enough in a relationship that you can fight, and you can work it out too. Most people realize that if we know how this is going to resolve, and I'm not going to resolve it for 4 more hours. I'm going to sulk. I'm going to run in the house, go for a drive. Then I know exactly what's going to happen 4 hours from now. But you know, you want to go through it because you feel like it. And if you realize that if you did that right now in front of the kids, you're actually role modeling for them negotiation and compromise in a really healthy way.
And the worst thing that can happen is maybe that a fight can escalate and then evaporate, disappear. That's when it gets taken behind closed doors.
Yeah, so that's
doors,
the interesting thing.
Right,
so
when parents think, we really got to get this away from the children.
The whole sort of take it upstairs phenomenon means parents start a fight in front of their kids and then go, wait, shouldn't be doing this in front of the kids. Let's go upstairs, or we'll talk about it later. And the kids are left wondering, you know, what happened? So that's the situation. And when they reproduce those experiments in front of kids, the kids there act really a lot more aggressive, and they'll punch pillows in these experiments, or they'll throw things. They'll be very upset to see fights start and not know where it's headed.
And if you feel a big fight brewing, maybe you should actually pull little Jimmy into the room.
No.
No.
It's
possible to take this stuff too far.
Mark is not – he's a careful scholar, and he would be abhorred if I said that. Like, you know, it doesn't say fight more in front of your kids. By any means, it just means really be attuned to the idea that you can, in these moments of passion, actually work it out amicably, sincerely. And he says faking it doesn't work. You know, the kids are sort of emotional Geiger counters. The same reason you can't hide conflict in the home from kids is the same way you can't fake conflict resolution in front of kids either.
This idea of kids having a chance to see conflict resolved and genuinely resolved is sort of juxtaposed, I think, with something else that probably surprised a lot of people who read the book, which is that you call out Arthur by name, the television show.
Yeah,
it sort of as a stand-in for this general set of, I would say kind of PBS, it's not all on PBS, of course, but style programming that we consider educational and beneficial. But there's not real convincing evidence at all that those kind of programs are better for kids than watching Power Rangers beat each other up.
Okay, well, just to be clear, educational television shows, do increase kids' pro-social behavior and improve their language comprehension. The kids are getting something out of these shows. But they are also dramas. And in being a drama, they dramatize relational aggression usually. Clifford is excluded by the two other dogs from getting to do something, and then at the end of the episode, you know, they make up. They spend the last 2 minutes sort of saying, "Hey, I'm sorry, I was wrong." But in the meantime, the characters are being cruel to each other, and kids who watch these shows actually learn new novel tactics to be cruel to each other that they'd never considered before. Now, this is, just so you know, this isn't controversial. I do describe a specific work by Jamie Ostroff there at a University of Buffalo. But To tell you the truth, we've been to lots of panels at lots of conferences, and it's the makers of Sesame Street and Nickelodeon right there saying they know they've known darn well for 20 years that educational television has this side effect of increasing relational aggression. Basically, it makes kids really bossy and manipulative. And the strong correlation there is much stronger between how much you watch and sort of how bossy and manipulative kids become than any sort of correlation between, say, Power Rangers or Star Wars and physical aggression on the playground. And they're doing lots of things to try to deal with this, but it really hasn't changed. So, again, I'm not saying educational television is bad. We have a question here, which would be exciting to hear.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, remember to tell us your first name and where you're from.
My name is Arpan, Arpan Jani, and I have a four-year-old son, and I would kind of agree with your observation because Caillou was his kind of favorite show. He's 4 years old, and we kind of observed that actually after watching Caillou, he was kind of learning new behaviors. I mean, earlier he wasn't going doing those kind of things. Now he would say, okay, this is what Caillou does. He is whining, and he's doing those kinds of things. And so in some way we kind of stopped that kind of show.
Yeah. Another interesting thing happens with the 296 most common and popular books and videos about sibling relationships, which typically are handed to siblings to help them learn to get along with their younger brother or younger sister. And Lori Kramer out of the University of Illinois is the world's leading expert in sibling behavior. She had her own little intervention to try to get kids to work better together, and then she had a control group, and she created a third group that she just gave them these children's books and these children's videos and said, read them every day. And she was afraid that those actual just off-the-shelf books were going to help families way more than her intervention was going to help families. In fact, reading the material every night, again, the kids were learning novel ways to be cruel to each other and dominate each other. The sibling behavior in that study got so bad, they had to end the study early. And so a lot of things that the way we construct things for kids, and if you watch this, they took the children to sibling books about sibling relationships, and they scored them as they would score a videotape of two live children interacting with each other. And the average book for siblings about sibling relationships has a feel-good ending, but in the meantime, the kids are mean to each other. And if you score it on a page-by-page, moment-to-moment basis, you see more negative and dominating behavior going on than positive behavior being role modeled for kids. So a lot of the things that we think are good for kids are backfiring in unexpected ways.
That's about respecting kids' attention spans, it sounds like, perhaps, that they're not always going to hang in there for the moral of the story.
Especially, like as our questioner was asking, you know, when they're 3 and 4, it's not that they're not paying attention, it's that they actually can't track the whole 22-minute story. And they know this to be true as well. And so we can watch it and go, oh, yeah, you know, we all know they're going to make up in the end. But the kids sort of, sometimes they see commercials in between too. They just see each portion of the story as a story into itself that they learn from.
Let's grab another question here right up front.
Hi, Jim from Minneapolis. So when is it appropriate to introduce concepts like fighting to our children? And how do we do that? Only after it occurs, or
you mean introduce how to stop fighting? Is that what you mean?
Well, so you talk about children experiencing certain situations in books,
yeah,
and then they adopt those, and
right.
Then they go and beat on their sister,
yeah. well, usually, again, it's not usually physical aggression. It's almost always relational aggression.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which would be peer exclusion.
That's a great question. Yeah, at a certain point, kids need to begin learning about conflict and seeing it, and of course we want the stories to be interesting for them, and that's the heart of any good story. So yeah,
right. Do you do it prior to, or do you wait until they experience it and then try and
well, I'll tell you what the experiments that have been done by all of the educational networks and children's networks, they try to have breaks. And they try to have, sort of teaching moment lessons before the show or breaks in the middle of shows in which they try to make it clear say there was a scene in Sagwa where one cat was excluded by the other cats and wasn't allowed to go on the adventure, and so her feelings were really hurt. Well, they'll stop the action, and they'll have another character come up to say, to make it really clear, you know, what they just did was bad. That's not, you shouldn't do that, kids. Kind of like a don't try this at home. You know, you should see how, realize how bad the other cat felt here, and let's feel for them, to direct their attention. And those work in the sense that they bring levels of relational aggression back to normal, but they don't actually make the kids less relationally aggressive than not watching TV at all.
It sounds like what a parent could do if you're watching the show with your child.
Exactly. It's what a parent should be doing. It's really the role of it. I mean, they do these things where they have other versions of the shows where they put chyrons underneath the show, which is sort of a prompt for parents to what to be talking to your kid about while you're watching the show with them. And those two are successful. And Nickelodeon created a great character to do this. And then the character was actually so popular that instead, that this was like 10 years ago, instead they used him to be like, he was so, the kids loved this character so much. I can't remember his name right now. But they used him to introduce the new shows, like to create the segue while commercials were running for new shows. And they, no networks quite had the heart or the courage to do this with what they're showing to kids.
Let's grab one more question before we move on.
You sort of answered my question already, and it was, what can parents do, or does it help to have parents intervene and point out, and while children are watching these television shows, you realize that they're not really being very nice to each other, and in fact, we don't want you to treat your sister that way. So have studies been done on this, and at what age are children cognitively ready to be able to respond to that and understand?
This is well studied. I mean, it's not just at that age. I mean, it's even when they're tweeners and they're watching Dawson's Creek, and there's, you know, sexually themed episodes where two characters are going in the bedroom, and you know, it's not you're not seeing anything, but it's implicitly, and every kid knows exactly what's going on. And in those situations, again, having parents talk about it and debunk sexual stereotyping and racial stereotyping that's going on overall for our kids' lives. I'm not against TV. I used to write for TV. I mean, but it's not that all this stuff is bad for kids. It's just that there is a role for a parent in discussing these things, and that does insulate kids from some of the negative effects while they still actually get the positive effects. Insults are another big thing. Insults are extremely common in children's television. And even in educational television, they're just as common as, say, Power Rangers and Star Wars, if not more. Again, it's another form of relational aggression, the put-down.
When did Star Wars become children's television? I think that's a good
When it became children's television when they re-released the movies, and Star Wars 1, 2, and 3 came out, and then they really everything was available on DVDs, and then they started having Star Wars on Cartoon Network.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt. That's a reference that surprised me.
Yeah.
I'm Jeff Horowitz. We're talking with Poe Bronson, co-author of Nurture Shock. And while we're talking about arguing here, before we move on to lying and racism and other fun topics, let's ask about teenagers and arguing with their parents. And this was a chapter that I went back and reread to try and understand it better, because it was complex, this relationship between teens and their parents, and the fact that I would think most parents want to have a very harmonious relationship with their teenager. They dream of that, and yet that may not be the ideal.
Right. 78% of American parents, according to polls, think their teens can tell them anything. The study on teens' lies, in fact, show that 96% of teens are actually lying to their parents. And the average teen who could lie of up to about 36 potential elements of their life that they might lie about commonly is actually lying. The average teen is lying to their parents about 12 of those things as we speak. And even the teens who lie the least are still lying to the parents about 5 of those things. So the idea as a parent that you're expecting your kid to tell you the truth all the time, and you have this great, you were so great chums when they were young, and then you nurtured them through those middle school years, and now you can tell each other anything. If you expect that, the science says you're just flat out naive, and you're going to be, but you're probably going to have a backlash because you're going to find out your kid is lying to you, and then you're not going to understand it. And so it starts with a baseline. Baseline is just kids are on a trajectory towards becoming independent adults, and they need some things to be none of your business. That it's psychologically emasculating to always come to a parent for help. You need to feel like some things they can handle on their own. In addition, the sort of the forces of autonomy and rebellion, actually, we think of them traditionally as sort of starting at age 12 or 13 and then peaking at age 18. They start at 11 and they peak at 14, and they're actually stronger in an 11 or 12-year-old than in an 18-year-old, largely because an 18-year-old, most American 18-year-olds, have carved out some independence for themselves at that point, and by then, a lot of them letting their parents back into their lives. And so what this tells you is that when they're 11 and 12, especially when they're sort of 13, 14, they're going to want a lot of things to be none of your business. And they don't start to begin to become domain-specific until a little bit more over time. So with all this lying going on, this is where our arguing comes in. And they know this from studies comparing, the best version of it was studies comparing American kids to Chilean kids to Filipino kids. And a teenager faces a choice when they're going to go do something with their friends that their parent would disapprove of. And their choice is tell their parent about it and then argue like heck with their parent about it, or lie to your parent about it. Those are the two choices. So when parents are arguing with their teenager, like, oh, we're arguing, this is terrible, it's destructive, this is torturous in this relationship, but they may not realize that that was a sign of respect to bring it up at all, to tell you the truth and to deal with it. And where they were able to realize this was from the Filipino children, teenagers. And the scientists fully expected, because of the long tradition in Asian cultures of respect for the elderly, that they would see a lot less arguing in Filipino homes. Instead, they found way more arguing. And they were really confused by this until the local scholars helped them understand, like, well, the teenager here in this videotape, he's arguing with his mom and dad over what time is the curfew, but he's not arguing over the right for there to be a curfew. There's a difference between sort of arguing over the rule and arguing over parents' authority whatsoever to set rules at all. And that the Filipino kids were respecting their parents. They were telling the truth, arguing, agreeing on some slightly modified version of the rule sometimes. And really it was a sign of respect, not of disrespect.
So there's something of kind of negotiating over time and building trust with each other that happens here.
Right.
The parent has to give in a little bit.
Same way we were talking about spouses or parents might need to negotiate and compromise in front of their child. They're role modeling a certain type of relationship. And this comes up again when working with a teen directly. Work by Robert Laird out of University of New Orleans and Nancy Darling out of Oberlin shows that kids who teenagers who actually occasionally win an argument with their parent end up having more respect and give their parent more authority. And if they never win an argument, then they just start lying. Just lie more and more and more. And so it's parents who occasionally, when a teenager has made a good argument, the truth is that rule is probably kind of old now, we don't need it anymore, that's Joe Allen at the University calls that money in the bank. It's teaching kids about negotiation and compromise, and they apply those skills they have with you to their peer relationships. So kids who can learn to do this over time end up having a lot better romantic relationships, friendship relationships, and relationships with the parents well into their 20s.
Let's talk about younger kids and lying, because I think we all would like to believe that that's something that we learn, you know, when we're older, and that as young children we're innocent and our default mode is to tell the truth. But the science tells us that's not true.
Well, no. The default mode for really young kids is to tell the truth. Learning to tell lies is actually cognitively complicated. Telling the truth is easy. Did you do this? Yeah. What just happened? You know what I mean? It's just repeating back like a playback machine. It's very cognitively easy. telling a lie is cognitively difficult. It remains plausibly coming up with some alternative excuse that could explain the broken vase, the drawing on the table, whatever it might be, and then under pressure and interrogation being able to continue the lie. So the science says that almost all kids will be experimenting with lying by their fourth birthday. And while we tend to think as parents, oh, they'll grow out of it, they grow into it. By the time they're six, they'll be lying twice as often in observational studies as they do when they're 4 years old. And it's developmentally normative, but that doesn't mean we should just, like, excuse it. Like, it's normal to learn to lie, to try to lie, but because kids will start to be called a liar on the playground, like, when they're six. And all kids will deal with this, and they'll lie to brag, they'll lie to smooth over social situations. Half of kids will get it socialized out of them by the time they're seven. Kids who are lying at six, half will get it socialized out of them by the time they're seven. But the other half tend to hang on to it as a habit. It becomes a sort of encrusted technique for smoothing over difficult situations, and it's sort of rather than sort of telling the truth in those situations. So dealing with children's lying is actually very important.
And in many cases, we're teaching our young children to lie, right? I mean,
yes.
This fine line between being polite, say,
there's a similarity here with educational television, understanding the whole arc of a 22-minute story where they can get all that. With parents, studies have say that, you know, we grown-ups lie all the time, but we're telling white lies predominantly. We're not lying to get off punishment or anything. We're just telling little white lies. But young kids can't understand the difference between a white lie and a lie to escape trouble. And so they see that they know darn well. You said, Mom, you said, told the telemarketer you weren't here, you know. Like, why? You're lying, you know. Or you told that lady you liked her cake. You told me you hated that cake. Like, and they don't understand the difference. And that sort of seems to sanction lying for kids. And that's not, they don't really understand the role of intent in lies till they're like 6 or 7 years old.
So some of the things you learned along the way here about kids and lying, how have those factored into the way you relate to your own children?
Yeah, well, the big thing was they do these studies where they tell kids in moments where they might lie, the story of the boy who cried wolf, which is the ultimate, you know, lying, you will be punished. You'll get the ultimate punish. You'll be killed by the wolf. Or they tell them George Washington, the cherry tree, when George's dad says, I'd rather have an honest son than 1,000 cherry trees. And the story of the boy who cried wolf, or any other sort of threat of punishment, actually increases children's lying and makes them much better lying. Because that you're going to get punished is no surprise to kids. And increasing the threat of punishment just makes them really like try to wiggle out of that with a better lie. Emphasizing honesty is actually what they really need to hear. And actually what they really want is to get back in your good graces. So working with kids means giving them immunity, kind of double immunity. You know, the first time for me, my daughter, she wrote on the table. And what I should have done was said right then, I said, did you do it? And, of course, she lied to me. She said, no. But since I read the science, I've learned to say to her when she's about to lie to me, I really want you to tell me the truth. You make me really happy if you tell me the truth. I'm going to be so happy. I'm not going to be mad about anything at all if you tell me the truth. I'm really offering lots of immunity.
Aren't you lying to her there when you're doing that?
No, because... Yeah, you're right. Because you know, it was writing on the table, big deal. Like, way more important is my child's moral development to me. So when she coughs up the truth in those difficult moments, and my daughter's kind of a conniving little girl too. So she, like last, I've been on a tour, and she tells her teachers, you know, I'm so sad. My daddy's on book tour, and she's like really worried. She is sad, but she knows she's learned she can play that. For lots of sham sympathy and stuff. So when she coughs up the truth, it's really meaningful. And she's gotten the habit of telling the truth around the home in a lot of circumstances where her personality says she would try to get away with something. And it comes from letting them know how to get back in your good graces, which is what they actually really want.
Talking with Poe Bronson, author of Nurture Shock, co-author, I should say, with Ashley Merriman. And we're here in the UBS Forum at Minnesota Public Radio. I don't want to let the hour get away without talking about race and your chapter about children's experiences with race. I'll give you a chance. Just sort of sum up the key insight that frames that chapter.
Yeah, so the key insight is that when we all want to teach our children to respect people of different cultures and colors, we all want to equip them with the skills to get along with people no matter where they come from in the world. And we absolutely want to make sure that we convey racial tolerance and to never have racial bias or discrimination. What we tend to do, though, with kids is say things like everybody's equal or God made us all the same. And these are actually lost on kids. One of my friends, she was like, you're right, I told my son for 6 months when he was five, everybody's equal, everybody's equal. And on his sixth birthday, he was like, Mom, you're always saying that. What's equal mean? The science, we tend to talk in code to kids when trying to talk about racial tolerance. And the science says, don't talk in code. Point out skin color. Tell kids we embrace people of any skin color. Teach ethnic and cultural identity at a very young age and teach kids to embrace it. And what we especially do if we do that is then talking about race does not become taboo. And what many parents do, I was one of them. I was the opposite. I thought I had my kids in a very diverse preschool. And my wife and I thought we'll never mention race or skin color. And it was sort of like we were going to give them this post-racial society, you know, that for this earliest part of their life. And that, of course, down the road, they'd have to learn uncomfortable truths, such as right here in America, there was lots of discrimination, and even is today, right here in America, there was a thing called slavery. That would be down the road. But in the meantime, let's give them this sort of post-racial bliss.
I think if we don't point it out, they won't notice it.
Right. And that racism can only be taught. And if you modeled successfully that no bias towards anybody, there would obviously be no sort of – kids wouldn't even notice skin color differences. The science says that's flatly ridiculous, that even babies notice skin color differences by the time they're 6 months old. By the time you're three-year-olds, if you hand them a deck of cards with kids' faces on them and you ask them to pick out ones that would likely be their friends, especially amongst white children, 86% will pick out other kids of white-faced kids out of the deck of cards. By the time they're five, if you hand them the same deck of cards and you ask them to sort it into two piles, 16% of kids will use gender to sort it, the piles. You've given them no idea how to sort it into two piles, any way you want, randomly even. 16% will use some random thing like every other card in front of the pile. 68% of white kids will use race to sort the deck of cards into two piles. And these are kids whose parents would swear, my kid doesn't even notice skin color. And his parents would say, I treat everybody the same, and my kid embraces everybody the same. And what's happening is we tell kids pink is for girls and blue is for boys. Skin color is something we leave them to figure out on their own. And we have no trouble telling our young kids about gender, about it's very important to know from the earliest ages that girls can do anything, and girls can be doctors, and do this, and boys, and get rid of gender stereotyping. But we have a hard time talking anywhere nearly as overtly and explicitly about these issues when it comes to skin color and racial and ethnic identity.
And these are white parents in particular have trouble having these conversations,
statistically, no, I've talked to tons of parents, no matter where they come from. Mm-hmm. Anybody can fall prey. They can have a really hard time. Statistically, 75% of white parents in America never or almost never have talked about race with their kids by the time they're done with kindergarten. It's only 25% for non-white parents. But there's still a lot of non-white parents who are still also have a very hard time with it.
I want to be sure as we get closer to 8 o'clock here, but get in any questions that we've got. Anybody had a burning question? Yeah, I'm sorry, you had your hand up earlier and we moved on. So let's get back to you.
You just made a point about statistically, people who are Caucasian do not, and 70, I think you said 78% of the time, they don't talk about race.
75%, yeah.
Well, anyway, very high statistic. And I'm wondering whether that has to do with the fact that they don't really have to talk about it, as they're the dominant culture. And every place that they look or turn, or whether it's TV, whether it's books, whether it's people in power, all these people are, you know, of their particular racial profile. And I was noticing a moment ago when you were talking about trying to make the distinction or trying to help children to be truthful and not necessarily lie and so forth, that even in your conversation, a very sophisticated, highly educated, well-researched individual such as yourself, you used a term that made me squirm a little. When you were trying to explain to the rest of us here that there was a distinction between a good lie and a bad lie, you naturally used the term white lie as a good lie. And that implies that any other kind of color...
It's just what they're called.
Right, and that's what
they're called that in the science.
Right, and this is what happens all the time.
Yeah.
This is what happened in every type of media there is. And I'm also concerned about the fact that the achievement gap that continues to persists because if you look around the room here, everybody here who wants to be a teacher, not everyone, but just about all the people here are white people. And they're the ones who are teaching black kids and other kids of color. And I don't know how we overcome the fact that they inherently believe, I'm assuming this, that they have a superior place in society. And that is somehow implicitly conveyed to the black child who's trying to learn, who's trying to deal with the confidence factor that you talked about. As well, I was also noting that you're telling us all the things that we're doing, that we've learned that we've been doing wrong. I haven't heard what we're doing right, except there was that one instance where you point out that Pokemon was something that was beneficial to your child. I'm very curious as to how that was beneficial to your child in more detail, but it just seems to me that there's just this whole system is set up in such a way that it has to be overhauled so that there's some way of bringing in, you know, diverse people so that the people with these different life experiences can somehow not even explicitly convey them to children, but somehow just by virtue of being there, the children pick it up.
There's a lot of good stuff there. Thank you very much. And I think just for the sake of picking a direction, I want to leap off your last point, which is, Nurture Shock is designed to sort of challenge conventional wisdom and look at all these things. In many ways, sort of the mistakes are misperceptions that we have as parents. But maybe this is a good chance for you to put it in bigger context. How wrong a track are we on? Are things really as bad as, say, you related a story before we started talking about a friend of yours who kind of panicked when they read the book, right? About how many things there are to fix.
And maybe I can weave this back a little bit, because generally speaking, the book tries to make zero broad claims that, like, parents are great these days or parents are bad these days. It's really more that in the science, there's a 10-year track record for each of these 10 chapters where the scientists have been studying something, reproducing it worldwide, and conventional wisdom somehow has missed that they're doing this. And we wanted to shed light on that to help educate and inform people. We weren't trying to say parents suck, or all parents are over-parenting, or all parents are helicopter parents, or all parents are raising spoiled children, or all kids are too driven, or too many kids are taking the AP. Like, it's just not what we're doing with the book. And none of those things are true. And so when you say them, all they do is provoke endless debate, because none of those statements are sort of true or not true. And we try to look at things where the science is saying, look, you know, these things are really legit and they're important to focus on. But to try to hit, please, you've said five things. Is there one thing you want me to hit there, if I could?
Primarily, the overriding theme for me and concern would be that we somehow identify or somehow cultivate the potential of all kids.
Right. Okay.
Not just kids who are of the dominant culture.
Okay, great point. So, Jeff, because you and I talked about this at the very beginning, which is that the science only recently has been able to even look at sort of what they call, like, just, you know, average kids, right? And the reason is that almost every scholar that I look that I deal with, their overall arcing motivation is to learn things that they can present and help educators with kids who are at risk in some way. And as you might note, that still presumes a sort of a superiority in that sense, that science has a superiority that can help people. But nevertheless, their motivation is not to build super kids. It's meant to help all kids level the playing field. And so that all kids can be given, raised in a culture, a society, in homes that can benefit them so they can sort of thrive. And that's the one thing about my sort of oath to these scientists is not just to come out and talk about here's how you engineer super high IQ kids. And this is why we spent a good half the book on the moral development of children. And I think if nothing else, like the science of how infants acquire language is, and that incredible science, which is completely unknown, could really help all kids come into kindergarten or come into nursery school by the time they're two, you know, speaking full sentences and having robust vocabularies. So there wouldn't be this achievement gap even before kindergarten begins.
Yeah, we have another question here.
Just listening, my name's Preston, with the kind of the group at St. Mary's wanting to become a teacher. One of the things that I'm thinking is, you know, you used a lot of examples, and part of the studies was like the ages of 5 to 7, the innocence. I'm seeing as innocence because they're just finding the differences there. I'm trying to get to the thought where they're not hating, they're not discriminating as far as these children, as far as, oh, they're a different color of skin. You know what I'm getting at?
You're talking specifically about racial attitudes?
Well, I mean, yeah, with kids, because as I'm becoming
No, it's not racism in that sense. You might start by calling it racial preference, but racial preference is racism.
Okay. Then for me,
but it still has a taint of innocence to it, you know.
Uh-huh. And the way that I took it away from the book was that at a very bottom base level, kids notice. They notice and they categorize, and you can't.
Right.
Stop that.
I mean, Monday night in Sacramento, a mom said to me, you know, an African-American mother, she said, my son went to kindergarten last week, his first day at school, and he came home and he said, Mom, I want to change my skin color. This is a mother who hadn't talked to her son at all about skin color and race and that kind of thing. And she was like, oh boy, what do I do? And I really felt for her. You know, and that her son was sort of like, I want to change, Mom. And he's, why can't I change? What? You know, and the statement was made with such innocence, right? But it strikes at our hearts in a way that almost makes us feel like, wow, we're dealing with hundreds of years of issues here. We can barely begin to unpack it and talk openly about it. But really, it's for the kids. Let's do it for the kids.
I can add to that. Because as a teacher, I'm like, okay, what, and even maybe if you have some ideas that you can share, because I'm kind of thinking, I'm not a parent to these kids. I'm here to teach, and obviously, hopefully my example of, hey, I care about you, I want to help you, you know, grow. I'm not here to kind of, in my thinking, depending what, you know, obviously what grade, I'm going into art, but, you know, things that you can maybe see as far as different age levels, what are some things that I can do as a teacher to kind of, I guess, encourage more of that diversity?
Yeah, well, I think these things need to be done in cooperation with parents because parents can be really surprised. It's also very important to be really racially sensitive, too. But, you know, I can only say that, you know, from my point of view, my son pours through his African-American sports biography histories, loves these things. And, you know, and he's in third grade now. So there's lots of ways with kids to use learning, to teach the great things about different ethnic cultures. And some of the difficult stories of ethnic history past of discrimination. or political persecution, or economic travails, or that and to actually teach these to kids over time and empower them with knowledge of different people so that they can then embrace people from all over the world rather than feel like it's taboo. And the biggest thing to watch out for is feeling like you're in silence, we're communicating taboo. And then we send kids to these diverse schools and we wonder why they self-segregate. And why not? We've made it taboo to even try to bridge these gaps. We can't even talk about it in our own homes.
As you said, the book tries not to draw specific conclusions many times, doesn't offer prescriptions. As we close, I want to ask, are there aspects of the science in your book that you're concerned about or that you've actually seen be misapplied or misinterpreted or misused?
So the science in the book, because I don't go all the way to the tips, you know, this covers the science, and then I leave you there hanging a little bit, like how to apply this at home, that it could get misused. Is that
sure,
the
or
idea?
How to apply it in a national sphere? I think he wrote recently about, you know, Rush Limbaugh seizing on your book to make some kind of some sort of point
about Republicans and Democrats,
right? That, yeah. You know, that seemed handy at the time, but I'm sure it's not where the science leads.
Yeah. These areas that are most sensitive about being misapplied are around conflict. They're around the science of arguing in front of your kids, arguing with your kids. People are really afraid that the science is very good on this, but they're afraid people are going to get the wrong message, that somehow I'm free now to have fights in front of my kids, or I'm free now to spank my kids, or or we're giving permission for some kids to be dominant and aggressive in the sandbox and in schools because we describe the science of that sort of social hierarchy formation in schools. But I don't feel that way. I feel like we trust the readers when they read the whole book through, and it's a very quick book to read. That the nuances of the science aren't lost on people.
Well, I would encourage everybody to check out the book. I certainly enjoyed it. And as a father of a 16-month-old, I've got a lot of years ahead of me. It gave me a lot to think about. And I think we probably touched on maybe half of the chapters tonight. There's a lot in there that we haven't been able to cover. Poe Bronson, thank you very much for joining us here at Minnesota Public Radio.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.